the coveted Indian crow and blue chatterer. He selected a specimen to photograph. The small blue chatterer's turquoise body practically glowed in his hands. Most blue chatterer skins for sale were half destroyed, their feathers picked and plucked at by generations of tires. A set of 10 feathers could fetch $50. Here were dozens of flawless, untouched specimens, each of which could be sold for at least $2,000. Each time he photographed a new species, he snapped a picture of its location. His camera's memory chip slowly filled up with a visual map of the vault. Edwin's mind raced beyond the sheer monetary value of the Tring's birds to the creative potential they represented. Ever since he tied his first Victorian fly 5 years earlier, his pursuit of perfection behind the vice had been defined by struggle. He'd made do with unconvincing substitute feathers, while watching wealthy tires outbid him at auctions of exotic birds. Despite his fame in the community, there were so many flies that he still hadn't tied, not least of which were the exorbitantly plumaged, thematical flies of his mentor, Luc Couturier. To now wade through a seemingly endless supply of birds unstoppered a river of creative possibilities in Edwin's imagination. There was nothing he couldn't tie. It was as if he'd stepped back 150 years to the era of Kelson and Blacker, when ships still sagged with crates full of exotic birds. He'd had 2 unsupervised hours to take as many photographs as he wanted. He knew Couturier had seen this room, and maybe only a few other salmon fly tires in the world. It had been an achievement to bluff his way in. But as soon as he walked out into the bright light of day, he knew he had to find a way back inside. Chapter 8. Plan for Museum Invasion. Doc. Edwin wandered back toward the train station in an altered state, charged by a magnetic reaction to the birds he had just seen. He had to find a way to see them again. It won't be easy, he thought, as the train sped back to London. He'd gained access under false pretenses, and the museum was unlikely to fall for the same ruse twice. Since he had signed in using his real name, he couldn't return under a different identity. Too many staffers had seen him. For months, he thought about how to get back inside the Tring. At first, it was a game, something to occupy his mind while he was sitting through lectures and practicing for ensemble performances. But as he descended deeper into his thought experiment, he realized that it wasn't simply about seeing the birds again. It was about taking them. If he owned these birds, he would have an unrivaled stash of feathers for the rest of his life. In a community defined by its longing for the unobtainable, he would be king, and his extravagantly plumed flies would be unmatched. Even better, he could feature them in the book on fly tying that he hoped to write, cementing his place in history alongside Kelson. But his desire to possess the birds was driven as much by pragmatism as by obsession. The global financial meltdown of 2008 had dealt a blow to Hudson Doodles, the Rist family's dog breeding business, nearly wiping out its customer base. In the face of a recession, $5,000 dogs were unnecessary luxuries. Edwin occasionally sent a little money home from student loan checks, but he knew it wasn't helping much. At the same time, auditions with orchestras were only a year or so off. And just as tires longed to work with expensive feathers, flautists yearned to perform with flutes forged from the rarest metals. While a nickel-silver flute could be bought for $50, the prices skyrocket as the metal becomes scarcer. From pure silver to 12-karat gold, 24-karat gold, all the way to $70,000 for a platinum flute. Despite multiple studies demonstrating that experts couldn't hear a difference and that he'd be auditioning behind a screen, Edwin had his eyes on a $20,000 golden flute, roughly the equivalent of what 4 Indian crows would fetch on the forums. At 20, the idea of stealing the Tring's birds glowed with potential to advance his ambitions as a flautist, to give him the life and status he coveted, and to provide for his family. Even better, the birds would be an inoculation against future hardship. Their value would only increase in time. And why, he asked himself, did the museum need so many birds after all? What earthly good was it serving to lock up dozens of skins from the same species? With such a vast collection, would they even notice if a few went missing? Maybe, he thought. If he could persuade the curators to let him back into the building, he could put a couple of birds in his pocket without anyone noticing. It'd be easy to do this with species like the Catinga, which were only 6 inches long and a tenth of a pound, the weight of a golf ball. But Indian crows were 1.5 feet long. Resplendent quetzals were 3.5 feet in length. How could he pocket a king bird of paradise without destroying its delicate tail feathers? Even if he found a way to conceal birds during a visit, how many trips would it take to build a respectable collection? How many times could he realistically do it before arousing suspicion? It would be better to steal them all at once. As he ducked in and out of class and rehearsal rooms, he thought through the details of the plan. How would he get inside? What route would ensure he remained inside the museum for the minimum amount of time? Should he start with the birds of paradise, the blue chatterers, or the Indian crows? How often did the guards make rounds? How many guards were there? Where were the security cameras? If he entered through a window, how would he climb back out with a suitcase full of birds? Would one suitcase suffice? He created a Word document titled Plan for Museum Invasion and started compiling a list of tools he'd need: grappling hooks, a laser glass cutter, and latex gloves to conceal his fingerprints. Sometimes during rehearsal, an inner voice would emerge and say, "This is ridiculous," but it was faint, always drowned out by the other voice pushing him forward. "If you're going to do it," that voice told him, "you need to start taking concrete steps to pull it off." The moment when Edwin's plans emerged from the realm of fantasy into that of reality transpired during a routine checkup at a doctor's office. While he was waiting in the examination room for the physician to arrive, his eyes fell on a box of latex gloves. "I'm gonna need a pair of those," he thought, pocketing them. And so Edwin's preparations began in earnest. On June 11th, 2009, 7 months after his first visit to the Tring, he ordered an 8mm diamond blade glass cutter through his eBay account. Flute Player 1988. To protect the spoils from insects, he ordered a box of 50 mothballs. He transferred the photographs from his camera to his computer and studied the proximity of one cabinet to another, assessing how long it might take to cover each of his coveted species. He pored over a map of the museum. He went online and studied maps of the town of Tring, its main streets, side streets, and alleyways. The train station was east of the town center, over a good 2 miles of dimly lit country road. It would be easy enough to slip into Tring, but once he arrived at the intersection with Aikman Street for the final quarter mile south to the museum, he'd be face to face with the Tring police station. But he had already discovered a less conspicuous approach. He had noticed a narrow alleyway running parallel to Aikman, weaving behind the houses and restaurants. The path, public footpath 37, would deposit him directly behind the ornithology building. There was a wall, but he could easily scale it. There was barbed wire, but he could easily snip it. There was a museum window on the second floor just a few feet from the wall, but he could reach it. All that remained in his planning was to select the optimal date. If he was to do it before the Royal Academy of Music's term ended on July 1st, when he would return home to New York, he was running out of time. The morning of June 23rd, Edwin woke up ready, confident. He performed at the Academy's London Soundscapes, a day-long tribute to composers who had left their mark on the city over the past few centuries, among them Purcell, Pepys, Handel, Haydn, and Mendelssohn. In his concert hall locker, he stashed an empty suitcase, a miniature flashlight, a wire cutter, the gloves, and the glass cutter. After the performance, he swapped his flute for the suitcase, made his way to Euston Station, and boarded an evening train to Tring. The Midland train is painted parrot green and toucan yellow, its ride quieted by a coffee-colored carpet. Just before the King's Langley stop, halfway to Tring, the Grand Union Canal appears and runs between the tracks and the A41 highway the rest of the way. A woman's voice murmured the name of each stop.
Wembley Central, Harrow and Wealdstone, Bushey, Watford Junction.
Edwin had 9 stops and 35 minutes to change his mind. His well-rehearsed plan had quickly gone off script. After he lost the glass cutter, it had taken several nerve-wracking minutes to bash enough of the window away to make room for his suitcase. But he was too charged with adrenaline to worry about cuts as he wriggled past the window frame's jagged edges into the museum. 1,500 unlocked steel cabinets lined the route he'd plotted, containing hundreds of thousands of birds. Only a small placard bearing Latin scientific names indicated their contents. His flashlight cast a faint dome of light as he hurried down the hallway, scanning for Katingadae, which included the Indian crow. He'd originally planned to take only a handful of each species, but when the moment came, he couldn't resist emptying out entire trays. The only Indian crows he left behind were the smaller females and juvenile males, which hadn't yet grown their orange breastplates. 47 Indian crows, weighing about a half pound each, fit neatly in his suitcase. Before proceeding to the cabinets containing the 7 species of blue chatterers, he carefully shut the cabinets to avoid arousing the suspicion of the museum staff. After relieving the Tring's drawers of 98 tiny blue chatterers, he made his way to the birds of the Malay archipelago. He pulled out a tray labeled Sericulus aureus, containing the 9-inch-long flame bowerbird of New Guinea, famous for a hypnotic courtship dance in which it raises its wing like a matador while dilating and contracting its pupils. He wedged 17 tangerine and golden skins into his suitcase. At last, he made his way to the birds of paradise. He maneuvered 24 magnificent rifle birds into his luggage, which was now brimming with several continents and centuries' worth of specimens. Still, he managed to find room for 12 superb birds of paradise, a species renowned for its bouncing courtship dance in which it shows off a stunning breastplate of iridescent aquamarine feathers. Upon arriving at the cabinet containing Alfred Russel Wallace's beloved King Birds of Paradise, he gingerly laid 37 of the birds, 5 of which bore Wallace's handwritten tags, into his suitcase. Edwin realized he had lost himself in the plunder. He had no idea how many birds he'd taken or how long he'd been inside, but he knew the guard's next round must be coming up soon. Whether he managed to get back out the window and into the anonymity of the street before their paths collided would depend on how efficiently he moved. He walked briskly through the corridors, wheeling his full suitcase behind him. By the time the guard finally got up from the soccer match, Edwin was gone, having climbed out the way he came in. As he made his way up the footpath, a tremendous wave of fatigue overcame him as his adrenaline subsided. He reverted to a kind of limbic motor movement, instinctively shuffling one foot in front of the other, breathing heavily as he emerged from the alleyway onto High Street. As he headed east, the storefronts yielded to houses, the houses to farms, and soon he was alone in the blackness of the ancient trees that formed a canopy over the narrow road, quietly counting off the 40 minutes until the faint lights of Tring Station rose in the distance. His original plan was to catch the 10:28, or failing that, the 11:38, direct back to London. The last train left at 12:16 a.m., but he was certain he'd be finished well before then. When he finally arrived at the station and checked the time, he realized he'd missed them all. By his estimation, he had been inside the train for nearly 3 hours. The next train home wasn't until 3:54 in the morning. As he sat on the platform with maybe $1 million worth of birds in his suitcase, he began to worry, for the first time in months of planning, about getting caught.
What if the guard noticed the broken glass on his next round? Had he remembered to close each of the cabinets? Had he left any fingerprints on the glass cutter? Was that a cut on his hand? Had any drops of blood fallen inside the tring? Could they identify him by his blood? Had he walked in front of any security cameras? Where was that glass cutter? What if they were already doing a dragnet at that very moment, fanning their way steadily outward from the scene of the crime with flashlights and bloodhounds, primed with the scent of dead birds working their way toward the station? He was exhausted, but he couldn't risk sleeping. Whenever someone walked over the nearby bridge spanning the tracks, adrenaline shuddered through him, snapping his weary mind awake with dread. The Midland train slipped into Tring at 3:54 a.m., its headlights scattering the shadows on the platform. He clutched his suitcase and waited impatiently for the doors to open, desperate to get far away from the museum and back to the city, where he could blend into the crowd of Londoners and luggage-toting tourists. He boarded, but the doors lingered open. A high-pitched beeping sounded from a box above the door. Had the conductor received some kind of alert? At last, the pneumatic doors shut with a solid, reassuring thump. A comforting, pre-recorded voice bade him, "Welcome aboard this London Midland service to Euston Station." Most of his fellow passengers were fast asleep. Rather than using the overhead rack, he kept the suitcase and its precious contents between his legs, resisting the urge to peek inside. As the train approached the next station, he peered nervously out the window, searching for flashing police lights or constables with canine dogs on the platform. But no such thing appeared. With each stop, the museum slipped farther away, and he began to relax. 40 minutes later, the automated voice announced, "We are now approaching London Euston, our final destination." Commuters gathered by the doors, snapping purses shut, zipping up jackets. "Please remember to take all of your personal belongings with you when you leave the train." He was almost there. Dawn broke as he hurried down the street toward his flat, suitcase wheels clacking noisily over the seams of the sidewalk. Hoping not to wake his housemates, he tiptoed through the apartment. Back in his room, the sunlight was already starting to filter in through the windows. Safe at last, he unzipped the suitcase and peered in at a flash of turquoise and crimson, indigo and emerald, hundreds of lifeless cotton eyes. As he spread them out on his bed with mounting excitement, he felt it was the greatest day in his life. It wasn't a dream. They were all his. He cleared a space on his bed and fell into a deep sleep. Chapter 9. The Case of the Broken Window. On June 24th, 2009, the Natural History Museum's on-duty security guard was halfway through his round when he noticed shards of glass near the base of the building. Perhaps a drunk had tossed an empty bottle over the wall of the nearby public footpath? He scanned the area until his eyes settled on the smashed-out window overhead. He hurried inside to inform the Tring's curators that there seemed to have been a break-in. The police arrived and began searching for evidence, examining the birdskin cabinets in the immediate vicinity of the broken window and scanning the ground outside. Mark Adams, the senior curator responsible for the Tring's birdskin collection, raced to the stacks containing the museum's most precious specimens. On the museum's staff since 1990, Adams had recently co-authored a journal article, "Extinct and Endangered Bird Collections, Managing the Risk," noting that damage and theft were increasing concerns. To protect these rare specimens, the Tring's staff had moved them to a high-visibility area adjacent to the curator's offices, where any activity in the collection may be easily monitored. Adams acknowledged the risks inherent in consolidating everything into one area. A fire could consume the entire collection in one swoop, for example. But he stressed that their approach meant that only a few key areas need additional protective measures to maintain security. Now, with an active crime scene, he feared the worst as he nervously unlocked the cabinets containing the Tring's treasures. the Galapagos finches collected by Darwin during the voyage of the Beagle, skins and skeletons of extinct birds like the dodo and the great auk, a collection of John James Audubon's birds, and an original bound edition of his Birds of America, the most valuable book in the world. Mercifully, nothing seemed to be missing. Asked by police for an estimate on when the window had been broken out, the security guard could suggest only a 12-hour period. All were puzzled about what the intruder had been after. The police mentioned that there had recently been a rash of smash and grabs around town by petty thieves looking for laptops and other electronics, but after a search of the staff offices, nothing of value appeared to be missing. A relieved consensus was forming. It appeared as though their culprit had poked his head in, looked around, and, finding nothing of obvious value, left empty-handed. He'd have become a rich man if he'd known how much Darwin's finches might fetch on the black market, or that Birds of America had recently sold for $11.5 million at auction. And so no systematic audit of the train's collection was ordered. Even if it had been, with over 1,500 cabinets housing 750,000 specimens and a small staff, a complete audit, which hadn't been conducted for at least a decade, could take weeks. Dr. Robert Press Jones, the museum's collections manager, was relieved that nothing appeared to be missing. A brief police report was written up, and the case of the broken window was considered closed. The glow of Edwin's successful heist was fleeting. He couldn't brag about it to his friends, his girlfriend, or his brother. He couldn't leave the birds out in the open in his apartment. He now had one of the greatest private collections of birds in the world, but he had to keep it a secret, or, eventually, come up with lies about where he had found the specimens. In the days that followed, he was consumed with paranoia and guilt. When the buzzer on his front door rang unexpectedly, a bolt of fear shot through him. He started sensing that people were following him when he walked through his neighborhood. Were the police already on his trail? What had they found that linked him to the crime? Even the ring of his telephone startled him. He considered taking them back. If he deposited them in front of the train and slipped off into the night, it would be as if the theft had never happened. Or, instead of returning to the scene of the crime, he thought about leaving them on a random street corner and calling the police with an anonymous tip. But both scenarios sparked new fears of getting caught. Walking away from a suitcase in a major city is pretty suspicious behavior, and there was no telling if cops were staked out by the museum. And why go to such lengths to take the birds, just to return them a few days later? After all, nothing had changed. He wasn't giving up his hobby. The mere sight of his haul made him ache to start tying again. But the rest of his equipment, the vise and bobbins and tinsel and threads, was back in New York. And while he was set to return home in a matter of days, it would be folly to risk bringing the birds through customs. He would have to wait until the fall to start tying, when he could bring his tools back to London. He still needed a new flute. His parents were still struggling, and the demand for a new supply of feathers within the fly-tying community, which had recently named Edwin Fly Tire of the Year, in the forum, was as intense as ever. Before long, the fear and guilt receded, taking with them any notion of returning the birds. Why should anyone care about some old birds taken from a musty museum, especially when it had so many to spare? He returned to the plan, beginning with an inventory. He carefully placed each specimen on his desk, unfurling the 2-foot-long tails of the resplendent quetzals and gingerly cradling the king birds of paradise as their iridescent jade disc plumes wobbled back and forth. He opened up a blank file on his computer and made a tally. He was astounded by the numbers. Had he really grabbed 47 Indian crow skins? 37 king birds of paradise? 39 resplendent quetzals? By the time he finished, he had logged 299 skins from 16 different species and subspecies. All the obstacles he had faced over the past decade of tying flies, the drudgery of splitting wood for hours just to be able to afford a few of John McClane's feathers, trudging to estate sales and antique shops in vain hopes of finding a bargain, calling zoos in search of molted feathers, tying flies with cheap substitutes while prized birds on eBay were snapped up by wealthy men, vanished beneath the pile of birds around him. Over a century earlier, George Kelson had bemoaned the difficulty of finding good bird-of-paradise feathers. But Edwin now had more than old Kelson could have imagined. Edwin had an unrivaled supply of product in a marketplace not dissimilar from the drug trade, crowded with self-professed feather addicts, white and blue-collar, young and old, near and far. There were two obvious ways to push the feathers. He could approach wealthier tires, doctors, dentists, and lawyers with capital, and offer to part with an entire skin. Under this model, essentially wholesale, he'd pull in a lot of cash up front. But the total revenue would be considerably less than if he harvested the feathers and sold them in individual packages. Such an approach, more similar to retail, would require dealing with a much higher volume of customers and smaller increments of cash. But he'd earn more in the long term. The easiest thing to do, of course, would be to sell the entire haul to a rich collector. But that would have negated one of the main goals of the heist, which was to obtain materials to last him a lifetime of tying. The retail model carried significantly more risk. If he sold to fewer people, he was much less likely to get caught. He probably wouldn't need to post anything online, thereby avoiding leaving a trail of incriminating evidence. If anyone asked where the skins came from, he would just say that he found them in a London antique shop or some unpublicized Victorian estate sale. Retailing would also require considerably more work, both in terms of the feathers themselves, harvesting them, and searching for matching pairs from each side of the cape, wing, throat, or breastplate, and, on the business side, drafting copy and photographing each feather for every posting. He'd need packaging, probably thousands of Ziploc bags. He'd need to handle distribution, figuring out how to send his product to buyers without attracting attention. He'd need to manage the finances, setting up accounts for online payments, not to mention customer service. When he wasn't at rehearsals, there would be the time-sucking distraction of constantly running down to the post office to mail feathers to impatient customers. He decided to try more than one approach. He would sell some individual feathers on the forum and eBay, and at the same time reach out privately to a few people who he knew might be able to afford a full skin. Laying out each skin on a dark gray piece of fabric, he trained his camera on the portions that would be most prized by his fellow tyers, concealing the labels tethered around the bird's legs, the words Mus Brit stamped in the corner. Using tweezers, he began the first harvest, plucking the rich orange feathers from the breastplate of an Indian crow. When he was younger, his dad had shelled out $2,500 for a full Indian crow skin from a collector on his deathbed in New Jersey, beating the line of eager fly tyers waiting at the door. But Edwin had never been able to bring himself to pluck all the feathers. Now, with 47 of them on the desk before him, he had no qualms tweezing the plumed bounty from the bird. The rest of the bird's black plumage was worthless to fly tyers. So once he'd removed the breast feathers and matched them into pairs, he tossed the skin into a large cardboard box by his closet. He started on the next one, and before long he had a small pile of bagged feathers. With only 6 feathers not much larger than a pinky fingernail, a single baggie might fetch $100. With his departure for summer break imminent, Edwin packed the birds and packets of feathers into a large cardboard box, carefully scattered mothballs inside to protect his collection from any interested insects, and stowed it in his closet, which he secured with an additional lock. Everything he wanted to sell was ready for distribution when he returned. So long as he snipped the tags from the skins before sending them off, no one would ever connect them to the Tring. As he boarded his flight home, weeks after the heist, nobody was looking for him. No one at the Tring even realized anything was missing. Chapter 10. A Very Unusual Crime. Over a month after the theft, on the morning of July 28, 2009, when Mark Adams showed up for work at the Tring, he had no idea how bad his day was going to get. While guiding a visiting researcher down the fluorescent-lit hallways into the bird collection, Adams pointed out the locations of various avian families and genera along the way. "Pirouderus guttatus is here," he said, as he opened a cabinet, just as he'd done countless times before with other researchers. But when he pulled out a tray of red-ruffed fruit crows, known to fly tires as Indian crow, all the adult male skins were gone. Heart racing, he yanked out another tray. Empty. Another tray. Empty. With the exception of one adult male skin wedged out of sight in the back corner, all that remained of the species were juvenile males, which hadn't yet grown their cherry orange breast feathers. An all-hands-on-deck call was sent out, and the Tring's staff scrambled to see if anything else had been stolen. They checked other brightly colored members of the Katinga family in nearby cabinets and discovered more empty drawers. Scores of blue chatterers were gone. They flung open the cabinet doors to the Trogon family, which includes the resplendent Quetzal, and found them empty. They expanded their search to include the birds of paradise and realized that dozens, including five of Wallace's, had vanished. Only the dull-colored females were left behind. They rang the Hertfordshire police to inform them that the case of the broken window needed to be reopened. Over the next couple of weeks, 1,500 cabinets were opened and thousands of trays pulled, as the devastated curators took stock of the loss. 299 birds from 16 different species. While it was too early to know for sure, they were beginning to sense that it hadn't been a scientific theft, since an obsessive collector trying to complete a collection of species would have taken the females and immature specimens as well. As their sweep continued, it became clear that whoever did this was after exotic birds with iridescent plumage. Who would steal a bunch of dead birds? At first, the question seemed almost comical to Detective Sergeant Adele Hopkin as she headed over to the museum. A single mother with shoulder-length brown hair and a warm yet no-bullshit demeanor, she had been on the force for nearly 20 years, making detective just a few years prior to the break-in. She worked plainclothes units, did undercover work, did her time on the drug squad, and also worked the Safe Neighborhoods programs, protecting vulnerable residents from fraud and harassment. As detective sergeant, she was now running a team in the Hertfordshire County Constabulary investigating robberies, burglaries, and violent assaults. She didn't live far from the museum, but hadn't visited often. Before getting the call that day, she'd never heard of Alfred Russel Wallace and had little sense of the importance of the Tring's collection. She did, however, understand that the investigation was already hampered by the length of time it had taken for the museum to realize it had been burgled. Whoever did this had quite the head start. Had it not been for the request from the visiting researcher to examine the Indian crow skins, it's unclear how much more time might have elapsed before anyone noticed something was missing. CCTV surveillance footage was held for 28 days. It had been 34 days since the break-in. As discouraging as this was, Adele doubted that the footage would have solved the crime for them. Tring wasn't a heavily monitored town, and she knew there weren't any cameras on the stretch of road between the town and the train station. "It's about 4 miles of nothing," she said. The thief's motive wasn't clear, nor were his methods. Had the birds been taken all in a single night? Or over several months, or even years? After all, it had been a decade since the last full inventory of the collection. Was it a single perpetrator or more than one? Did they arrive by car or on foot? Could it have been the work of a crime syndicate? For years, a network known variously as the Irish Travelers, the Rathkeel Rovers, or the Dead Zoo Gang had been involved in a series of thefts of rhino horn and Chinese jade from museums across the globe, including in the UK. Initially, Adele wondered if it was an inside job, someone sticking the precious specimens down their trousers, a couple of skins at a time. But she quickly ruled out the possibility.
Interviews with the museum staff revealed how crushed they were by the theft. She asked the museum to point out the window that had been broken. The beat policeman had inspected it back when it was first reported, but she wanted to take another look. It was about 6 feet off the ground. A tall enough person could hoist himself in, but it wouldn't be easy. Her eyes swept the area beneath the window and settled upon a gutter meant to catch bits of cladding and debris that might fall from the roof. Crouching down amid the broken glass, she found a bit of a latex glove and a glass cutter. On one of the shards, she found a drop of blood. She bagged up the evidence her colleagues had missed and sent it off to the National Forensics Laboratory. As Adele poked around the crime scene, the museum was beginning to come to terms with the scope of the theft and the specter of a public relations crisis. The loss of so many irreplaceable skins, which would create a significant gap in the scientific record, was a deeply embarrassing blow. That it had apparently been so easily accomplished only made things worse. As the tally of missing skins mounted, so did the scale of the Tring staff's sense of failure as custodians of natural history. Mark Adams was hit hard by the burglary. He saw himself and the others as just one link in the centuries-long chain of curators entrusted with looking after the specimens, and they had failed. But it wasn't the first time the Tring had been burgled. In 1975, a man in a wheelchair appeared at the museum's entrance, asking to speak with the curator about the egg collection. Mervyn Shorthouse explained that he'd been severely injured in an electrical accident at work and was now on disability, and that eggs were now his only joy in life. The museum took pity on him, recalled Michael Walters, then head of the Tring's egg collection, and granted access on compassionate grounds. Over the next 5 years, Shorthouse paid over 85 visits to the Tring's eggs, until a suspicious curator spotted him slipping some of them into his pocket. When police searched him outside the museum, they found 540 eggs in his baggy overcoat and in his car. Back home were another 10,000. It was soon discovered that the electrical accident that had disfigured Shorthouse had in fact occurred in the midst of another theft, when he had attempted to steal cable by hacksawing through a live high-voltage line. At the trial, the prosecutor lamented the incalculable damage to part of the national heritage, and established that Shorthouse had been selling eggs to other private collectors, often removing any identifying markings to cover his tracks. Shorthouse was sentenced to 2 years for his crimes, while Walters spent the next 25 years and the rest of his career trying to sort through the damage to the integrity of the collection. In another infamous case, Colonel Richard Meinertzhagen was banned from the British Museum's bird room for unauthorized removal of specimens. But Meinertzhagen, a distinguished officer in the Levant during the First World War and a prolific birder and ornithologist, had Lord Walter Rothschild lobby the London Museum to revoke the ban. After only 18 months, the colonel was allowed back in, but for the next 30 years, the curators remained suspicious that he was stealing birds. Upon his death in 1967, his private collection of 20,000 specimens was donated to the museum. But it was decades before the scientific community realized what Meinertzhagen had been up to. In an attempt to burnish his legacy as a world-famous collector, he had replaced the labels on birds collected by others and fraudulently claimed them as his own discoveries. In doing so, he cast into doubt the veracity of the invaluable biodata on the labels of many of the affected species, none of which were part of the newest theft. Dr. Press Jones, the bird collections manager at the museum, had spent a depressing amount of time over the past 2 decades evaluating the extent of Meinertzhagen's fraud. He knew that there had been a series of bird skin thefts in previous years at other museums whose curators hadn't rushed to publicize what happened. Between 1998 and 2003, a pest controller at the Australian Museum named Hendrikus van Leeuwen had stolen more than 2,000 skulls and skeletons during his unregulated nighttime access to the collection. More recently, the Naturkunde Museum of Stuttgart had suffered a loss of bird skins, mostly from the Katinga family. But the thief was never caught, and as so often happened, the burglary was not made public.
Press Jones was particularly invested in tackling the challenges faced by natural history museums throughout the world. In November 1999, he convened a conference in Aston, Clinton called Why Museums Matter, Avian Archives in an Age of Extinction. 130 curators from 25 countries participated, representing natural history museums in Europe that housed nearly 4 million bird skins among them. The Tring was the most prestigious, with four times as many skins as the second largest collection in the Naturalis Biodiversity Center in the Netherlands, and dwarfing the few thousand skins held by museums in Luxembourg, Norway, and Italy. All faced similar pressures. Public funding was on the wane, while the threats posed by theft were constant. Following the conference, the Electronic Bulletin Board for European Avian Curators, EBEC, was established to bring together the extensive community of curators and to help time-strapped staffers stay abreast of the countless obsessions driving black markets for particular specimens. If a museum suffered a theft by an organized network, other curators throughout the world would be on heightened alert. The Tring volunteered to host the computer running EBEC. In this case, the system hadn't worked. The Tring staff had had no idea that these particular species had become valuable enough to steal. Making the theft public would mean risking their reputation, but the museum's directors reasoned that it was worth risking embarrassment to try to recover the skins. Plus, Adele needed leads. It would take a while to get forensics results from the National Fingerprint Database, and if there wasn't a positive match to a known criminal, she wouldn't have anything to go on. Their best hope was that a member of the public might come forward with information. Beyond finding the culprit, she had another urgent mission. After the Meinertshagen and Shorthouse affairs, in which labels were either removed or changed, it was vital that she recover the birds with their biodata labels intact. Finding them without their tags would create an impassable void for researchers, as few meaningful inferences could be drawn from a skin without knowing the date and geographic details of its collection. An educated guess could be made based on the types of materials and cotton used to stuff a specimen, but it would be a painstakingly slow and less than conclusive process. With Adele's assistance, the museum drafted a press release announcing the theft. "It is very distressing that we should have been deliberately targeted in this manner," Richard Lane, the Natural History Museum's Director of Science, lamented in the release. "Our utmost priority is working with the police to recover these specimens to the national collections so that they can be used by future generations of scientists." "This is a very unusual crime," Adele's supervisor, Detective Inspector Fraser Wiley, was quoted as saying. "We are appealing for anyone who may have seen any suspicious activity around the museum in the time around when the break-in was, before it, or subsequently." The police included their contact information along with a Crime Stoppers hotline number where anonymous tips could be shared. A handful of media outlets in the UK, including the BBC and the Telegraph, ran brief articles, and a few sites like Nature.com and the Association of Academic Museums and Galleries posted about it. But the release found its widest distribution in the various online fly-tying forums. Flyfisherman.com, FlyTyingForum.com, and Edwin's favorite online haunt, ClassicFlyTying.com. Chapter 11. Hot Birds on a Cold Trail.
"Somebody stole birds from a museum," Anton exclaimed on the other end of the line. "It's on the forum."
Edwin had just returned to London from summer break. He hurried over to his computer and found the press release. A statement from Detective Inspector Fraser Wiley caught his eye.
"We would ask any collectors of such specimens to keep a watchful eye out in case they are offered anything resembling them."
The police were still groping in the dark. Wiley suggested the birds might have been stolen by a gang of thieves on behalf of a collector, and that 299 birds would fill up to 6 garbage bags. When asked by journalists why these particular birds might have been targeted, he shared his working theories, that a dressmaker or jeweler might have commissioned the theft in pursuit of iridescent feathers for their craft.
"We keep an open mind," he added,
mentioning one other theory.
there may also be a need within the fishing market.
At that point, with a formal investigation underway and a public call for leads, Edwin knew that it was too late to return the birds to the train with a simple apology. He considered stowing the birds away for years, maybe decades, selling them only after the police stopped searching. Or he could go ahead with his plan, making sure that he supplied a good enough cover story for each sale he made. How bright were these people anyhow, he reasoned, if it took them a full month to realize they'd been robbed? Surely they'd forget about them soon enough.
In October, shortly after starting his third year at the Royal Academy, Edwin purchased 1,100 small Ziploc bags, 2.25 by 3 inches, ideal for storing individual feathers. He also ordered 500 medium-sized bags, 4 by 5.5 inches, perfect for storing patches of feathers sliced from the skin. On November 12th, he logged on to classicflytying.com, navigated to the trading floor section of the forum, and created a new post. Indian crow feathers for sale. Buying new flute. The time has come for me to upgrade my instrument, he wrote, and I am selling some crow feathers to help this along. In describing his wares, he used P.S. for the Latin binomial Pyroderus scutatus. There are 2 subspecies, P.S. scutatus and P.S. granadensis. All are super A quality. I have limited numbers of granadensis, so first come, first serve. There is no limit on the number of feathers you can buy at a time. Prices are scutatus large, 10 feathers, $95. 10 medium, $85. 10 small, $80. Granadensis, 10 large, $120. 10 medium, $95. 10 small, $90. The post included high-resolution photographs of the black and orange-tipped feathers. The response was ravenous. The following day, he ordered more Ziploc bags. These ones large enough to ship full bird skins. 2 days later, he logged back in to announce that only a limited number of Indian crow feathers remained. So if you still want some, now is the chance. On November 28th, Edwin uploaded a photo of the small turquoise blue chatterer to ebay.co.uk. Using an account he'd registered a couple of months prior to his first visit to the Tring. Flute Player 1988. When news of the auction hit the forum, there was a surprised reaction. Angler Andrew. From Britain as well. I've never seen one on eBay from Britain. Anyway, there's about 10 mins left, and still no bids. Man, if I won the lottery... Mong Quarter. The seller is Flute Player 1988. Edwin Rist sold some Indian crow to pay for a new flute recently. Coincidence? Maybe. However, I suspect the seller is Mr. Rist, so it should be good quality and from an honest seller. Mitch. Anyway, I wish him well and hopefully gets his flute before Christmas. Cheers. Meanwhile, Adele was still waiting on the forensics results from the bit of latex glove, the drop of blood, and the diamond blade glass cutter. She was skeptical that a match would come back. A more experienced burglar, the kind with prints already on file, would have been more careful about removing potentially incriminating evidence. In the meantime, she contacted the National Wildlife Crime Unit, charged with enforcing anti-trafficking laws. Formed only 3 years earlier, the police unit specialized in gathering intelligence on wildlife crime, working closely with various branches of law enforcement, including the UK Border Force, which maintained a dedicated CITES team trained in identifying protected species at Heathrow Airport. Adele asked them to be on the lookout. If an agent discovered someone with a bunch of exotic birds, she wanted to be the first to know. Around this time, Mortimer, a dentist and avid fly tyer from the Pacific Northwest, landed in London for an 8-hour layover on his return from a fishing expedition in Africa. He took a cab to the Jury's Inn, where he found Edwin waiting in the hotel restaurant. Edwin didn't seem particularly concerned about displaying his wares. He ordered a beer and laid out a handful of species that his customer had expressed an interest in over email. As Mortimer inspected the skins,
Edwin told him he was helping a pair of aristocratic collectors sell off their collection as a way of funding his studies. Mortimer, unsure of their legality, was wary of returning to the airport with the birds, so he put a hold on three of the choicest skins. A flame bowerbird, an Indian crow, and a blue chatterer. He sent Edwin a check for $7,000. When the package arrived at Mortimer's dental practice, he found a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service inspection sheet inside, which meant either that Edwin had forged documents or that the federal agency had opened it mid-shipment, examined the birds, and waved them along. At 87, Phil Castleman is arguably the community's longest-running feather supplier. Proprietor of Castle Arms of Springfield, Massachusetts, he has been selling feathers for 64 years to a mailing list of customers that approaches 1,500 names. His showroom, which includes pelts of fur, taxidermy birds, and a collection of more than 100 framed salmon flies by the world's best tires, is open by appointment only. Castleman kept a close eye on movements in the marketplace, and he would generally hear if a competitor was about to offload a lot of skins or an obsessive collector was looking to buy. Shortly after Edwin started selling, Castleman's phone began ringing as fly tires tipped him off to the auctions of rare birds in England, wondering whether they could be legally shipped to the United States. He did a lot of business in Europe, but didn't know anyone in England with a collection like that for sale. But while Castleman fielded calls from cautious fly tires, Edwin found that his buyers, many of whom he had known since his earliest days tying, weren't asking questions. He knew that their addiction to these birds meant they wouldn't ask questions to which they'd rather not know the answers. For those whose conscience demanded it, though, he offered a menu of fabricated stories regarding each skin's provenance. Some had been discovered in overlooked corners of antique shops, others scooped up at a provincial estate sale. His birds of paradise had come from a friend in Papua New Guinea as part of a trade. As 2010 approached, the search for the thief, or gang of thieves, was short on leads. The curators had reviewed their email correspondence with people who had expressed an interest in the species targeted in the theft. Two initial suspects emerged, a Canadian named Luke Couturier and an American named Ed Muzzerall. Just a couple of years prior, both had inquired about the possibility of buying some of the museum's skins, but had been turned away. Adele ruled them out as culprits, but remained unaware of how close she had come to the thief, who had learned to tie his first salmon fly with Muzzerall, and had first heard about the Tring's collection from Couturier. Although the museum's curators had publicly expressed a strong desire to recover the skins, they had privately come to the conclusion that the stolen specimens had likely already been broken up and separated from their tags and were no longer of scientific value. Whether this pessimistic assumption colored the police investigation is unclear. What is clear is that the thief was right under their noses. One of the working theories was that a fly tire was behind the theft, and any web search for the species in question would have yielded a number of hits at classicflytying.com, including discussions of Edwin's birdskin sales on eBay. His forum posts had used the Latin names for each species, the very names now affixed to empty cabins at the Tring. The two previous major thefts at the Tring, Shorthouse's eggs and Meinertzhagen's skins, had been perpetrated by known visitors to the specimen stacks. Had the latest thief also come to the museum prior to robbing it? No more than a couple of hundred visitors were likely to have entered the vault during the previous calendar year. If their culprit had staked out the museum under false pretenses, surely his or her name would be in the logbook. The name Edwin Rist was, of course, there, on a page dated November 5th, 2008. If they had run an online search for Edwin Rist, they would have found a number of websites connecting him to the world of salmon flies and his eBay listings. But 6 months after the robbery, they were still in the dark. Adele's day-to-day work, tackling domestic abuse cases, breaking and entering, and other robberies, continued apace. If the Tring's curators ever turned up a good lead, she'd investigate. But for the time being, the case moved into the unsolved bracket. At the dawn of the new year, everything was coming up aces for Edwin. Whenever he needed an infusion of cash, he'd post some feathers on eBay or the forum, which would sell in less than a day. A quick trip to the post office, and the money would pour in, repeat as necessary. On March 6th, he packed a number of skins he was open to selling, if the price was right, and headed up to the spring fly fishing show in Newark, a few hours north of London. Dave Karn, who had recently sent Edwin $3,500 that he'd borrowed from his elderly mother for a cape of feathers from a prized subspecies of Indian crow, was excited to finally meet him in person. Karn had been tying salmon flies since he was 13, when he often spent his pocket change on florican bustard and jungle cock feathers from the fishing tackle shop where he worked. At the show, Karn saw Edwin sell a full blue chatterer skin to Jens Pilgaard, a Danish blacksmith renowned for his collection of hand-forged blades of mottled Damascus steel, medieval weapons, and Viking jewelry. Pilgaard also sold fly-tying materials as the proprietor of Fugl and Fia Flubinding, Danish for bird and feather fly-tying. As the Dane tied a fly in front of a small audience of admirers, Edwin approached him with his skins. "Why are you selling this?" he asked, as he and his audience marveled at the quality of the feathers. When Edwin replied that he needed money to buy a new flute, the Dane bought a breast patch of Indian crow, a flame bowerbird cut into a few pieces, and a blue chatterer skin. The bill came to about $6,000, along with a commitment to send a Malayan peacock pheasant skin, worth another $4,500, from his collection back home in Aarhus, which Edwin could sell to his growing customer base. In April 2010, Edwin hopped on a flight to Japan. He had recently started taking Japanese at King's College London, even taking part in the International Japanese Speech Competition. He bought a travel pass, visited Tokyo and Kyoto, and rode the bullet train. He packed some materials so that he could tie a popham fly in the park under the sakura cherry blossoms, wrapping fine silk around Indian crow and blue chatterer feathers. When he got back to England, he sent a follow-up note to Jens, letting him know he'd spoken to his bird of paradise contact and that he would be able to get several king birds of paradise. Pilgaard had seen only a couple of skins of that species over decades in the feather business. How had a 21-year-old American student in London managed to find a supplier? Even as the online residue of his transactions spread and spread, Detective Hopkin and the Tring curators were still without a suspect. The National Wildlife Crime Unit hadn't turned up any bird skins at the airports. The forensics on the drop of blood, the latex glove, and the glass cutter hadn't yielded anything useful. The search for the missing skins had officially gone cold. Safe as he felt, Edwin had no way of knowing that in 1 month's time, hundreds of miles away in a small Dutch town, one of his customers would make an offhand comment that would bring it all crashing down.
Chapter 12. Flute Player 1988. If there was one specific moment when Edwin's plans began to unravel, it was in late May 2010 at the Dutch Fly Fair outside the small city of Zwolle, an hour and a half east of Amsterdam. The festival, convened every 2 years, was held in crisp white pagoda tents beneath the Swedish, Dutch, and Icelandic flags that flapped over the shores of the Drontemeer Lake west of town. Massive salmon steaks were roasted on cedar planks over medieval coal baskets, and a pair of bagpipers announced the entrance of the king, who strutted about comically with a velvet robe and a scepter-shaped fishing rod. In the main tent, where dozens of tyers from around the world convened to demonstrate their skills on an elevated stage, a Dutch construction engineer named Andy Bocholt was at work on a salmon fly using hard-to-get feathers. Nearby was Chuck Ferimski, manager of the International Fly-Tying Symposium in Somerset, New Jersey, known for his trademark handlebar mustache. Vintage reels and fly rods gleamed from nearby glass cases. Also present was a man from Northern Ireland. Irish was 2 decades into a career in law enforcement.
He had operated undercover during the worst years of the Troubles, narrowly surviving multiple bombings and shootings. To keep sane in those dark times, he had taught himself to tie, starting with simple shrimp flies.